This is Karen Brewster, and today is October 9th, 2025, here in Juneau, Alaska, interviewing Steve Behnke for the Subsistence Research Legacy Project. And Jim Fall is here with me as well as a co-interviewer. And then on the phone from Fairbanks is Bill Schneider listening in and maybe adding some questions as we go along. So, Steve, thank you for your time today. And just to get things started, do a little bit of your background so we know who you are and, you know, your growing up, where you came from, how you got into this business of subsistence.
Okay. Yeah, so I grew up in the Mat Valley on a homestead that my parents moved to in 1955, so I had a great Alaska growing up experience, which actually played quite a bit into things later on, because by the time I was in high school, one of my favorite activities was looking for Dena'ina house pits and fish pits in the area around Big Lake, and that really was a big influence and interest of mine, was how people kind of led into my interest in how people lived in on the land. I went to University of Alaska in Fairbanks in 1969 to 73. Graduated there in 73 with a geography northern studies degree. And I believe, and Bill might remember this, might not, but one of the projects that I got involved in was looking at the archival materials of Don Foote, who was a human geographer who worked in the Kobuk and northwestern Alaska areas. And I was really interested in his materials, discovered that there was a whole archive full of the stuff that he had left. And I'm pretty sure Bill was involved in that material at that time and helped me find stuff and let me in to see those things. And that played a major role, because then I went to McGill University for a master's degree, and that's where Don Foote had been. It was just kind of a coincidence in a lot of ways, but there was somebody at McGill who was kind of doing similar things to what Don Foote had been doing. So Bill Kemp, who was a geographer there. So I went and that led me into Inuit Land Use and Occupancy Project that I worked on while I was at McGill. Got to go up into the Fox Basin, Hall Beach, Shiglulik communities and did 4 or 5 months of field work documenting traditional land use, mapping land use in those areas. Part of the big Milton Freeman and Hugh Brody, Bill Kemp project at that time. And then that led into kind of my next fun project, which was I got hired for an archaeological survey out of the proposed Lake Clark National Park. Worked a summer doing that, and that next year wound up getting contacted by the Cooperative Park Studies Unit and then doing a subsistence study of the proposed Lake Clark National Park. So that'd probably be 1975, 76, somewhere. Yeah, I think the report was probably 77. But and then another series of typical Alaskan events. Steve Brond and I put in a proposal to Mineral Management Services for a socioeconomic assessment of Lower Cook Inlet oil development. And while we were waiting to hear whether we were going to get that contract or not, Steve Braun said, Steve, you better finish your thesis. You got a little time here. Finish your master's thesis, which I'd kind of put on. I just kind of set aside. So I sat down that fall of maybe 1978 or so and finished that long overdue master's thesis. And then in the course of that, met Tom Lawner, who was directing that program, that mineral management program. And then when the new subsistence division was created and starting to look for people to hire in 79, I guess I was one of five or six original resource specialists that were hired in kind of mid-1979, or fall 79, I guess. And kind of remember this. I kind of remember having a choice of which area to go to, and there were several possibilities, and I knew Dillingham the best and had worked out in Bristol Bay and worked in Nondalton and worked in the Bristol Bay region, and I knew that Dillingham had more trees than any of the rest of those places put together, except for Southeast Alaska, which I didn't have any contact with Southeast Alaska, so I chose to go to Dillingham and started developing a subsistence research program in Bristol Bay. That's probably enough for an intro start there.
So you lived in Nondalton when you were doing the parks, the cooperative park studies?
I was actually living up at Lake Clark most of the time, my ex-wife was substitute teaching in Nondalton, so she'd fly down from Port Allsworth, and then I went and spent time down there. We had a dog team that I was training a leader, and the guys in Nondalton helped me build a birch sled, a dog sled, which was a great introduction to the guys in Nondalton who just jumped in and said, yeah, well, cut down some birch and we'll go to the school and we'll cut the materials with you and I'm sure I could reconstruct who that was. It was several different people, but yeah.
So do you remember your first days then on the job in Dillingham with the department?
I've been trying to remember. I think a lot of it's a blur because there was a lot going on. I mean, it was moving out into this place. And
had you been in Dillingham before?
I had been in Dillingham. Yeah, I had been in Dillingham. Yeah. I think during that earlier project, I had been down to Dillingham and met some of the people at BBNA you know, a few. So I had, and I'd been in some of the other communities, I guess, too, because I'd been to King Salmon and a few of those places, but it was still a lot of new stuff. Had to get a vehicle out to Dillingham when a family moved, so I can picture, you know, I can picture a little bit of it, but it was a lot of new stuff because both Dillingham and the department. Of course, I'd never worked for Fish and Game, although I knew a number of Fish and Game people in King Salmon, probably had met at least a couple of the people in the Dillingham office.
And did they greet you with smiles or skepticism? Or
well, I think it was a little bit of a mixture. It was a mixture for sure.
Launching the program.
I was launching the program, but of course it was kind of low key. I mean, I'm kind of not a pushy kind of guy, so it was kind of, you know, meeting people. It was in the, I'm pretty sure it must have been late summer, because I think there was there was a lot of activity. I mean, there was fishery stuff going on. So, and One good thing about it was it was a new game biologist who had just moved. Who
was Ken Taylor.
Ken Taylor, yeah. Was arriving just the same time I did. So mm-hmm. It was kind of like there wasn't somebody with a strong presence there. Of course, the commercial fisheries people had been there.
It was Mike Nelson,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, Mike Nelson, mm-hmm. Jeff Scrady.
Okay.
And they were actually pretty good. I mean, they were pretty open. I think that they kind of thought I was going to take over subsistence fishery monitoring, you know. I mean, like, that's what they thought this was all about. So there was, I kind of remember a little tug and pull about that, of saying, well, that might be part of what we help out in the long run, but in the meantime, we kind of got to figure out what this program's going to be and got to understand more about the region. So they were, and I do remember they were pretty helpful at, you know, talking about, I mean, I would meet with them or sit in the office meeting. It wasn't meeting, it was sitting around in the office and hear about the fisheries and the different areas, and they were quite good about sharing information mm-hmm. about that.
Were you in the same building with them back then? Because later on we weren't.
I don't think so. I think we were in a different building. Yeah, I think we were in a different building because I would go over they were in kind of this old building there. So I think I would go over and...
Because I was going to ask how you just set up the building and offices, you did that.
Yeah, and I don't really I can't really picture that. I think there was space that when I got there was some kind of space that mm-hmm. was mm-hmm. usable, and I can kind of vaguely picture it, but I don't really even remember where it was. Yeah, okay. It probably was the same place it was when you started out there, I imagine.
Yeah, there was that older building that eventually became the bunkhouse, part of the bunkhouse, and they built a new office later on, and that Subsistence moved into. But
yeah.
Subsistence was in that old house that was down the hill from the school.
Yeah,
there
yeah.
that no longer exists.
Yeah, yeah.
So, did you get any marching orders from Lana and Cunningham and whoever else was running the show when you got out there? What were you supposed to do?
It was pretty vague. It was pretty broad. It was figure out what's going on with Subsistence in Bristol Bay and Tom Lana. I'm trying to picture how the communication really occurred, because certainly there was some phone calls, and there was some written materials that Tom had provided, a lot of which was kind of really pretty high level, you know, social science concept, you know, participant hours of it, you know, look around, see what's going on, figure out how to work, you know. It was very, which was okay with me, because I kind of had done enough stuff and, you know, in other places to have some idea what I thought I could do, and having the broad umbrella was fine, because that's kind of how I viewed it. Got to figure out who's who, who's where, you know, sort of got to start with some of these broad basics. So I kind of took advantage of stuff that other department people were doing. So Ken Taylor was new, and I, you know, flew up into some villages and walked around and talked to people, and there really wasn't, you know, I mean, it wasn't really any real, especially early on, I mean, it wasn't really real protocols of, you know, trying to get, you know, asking official permission from communities, although I certainly did that. I mean, I would touch base with folks at BBNA and the other organizations, and I would try to meet with community leaders, you know, as much as you could. But certainly, like I say, it wasn't very formal, mm-hmm. that kind of a process. It was.
Did those leaders or BBNA, did they know what the subsistence program was? Did they know in advance that you were going to be out there?
Yeah,
what it might be.
I think it, as I recall, the folks at BBNA, and there may have been another organization, trying to remember whether there was, can't remember what point there was, because there were other advocacy organizations, it was another advocacy organization, but I don't remember what it was.
Oh, I don't either.
Yeah, and maybe it really was, maybe it was some subset of people at BB&A. So they seemed to know, I mean, as I remember, they kind of vaguely knew that this thing was going on.
Yeah. And well, Nels Anderson is from Bristol, from Dillingham.
From Dillingham.
And he was the sponsor of the law. Yeah.
So there were people there who definitely did. And there was a lot of interest. I mean, obviously the fishery stuff was of interest, like it always is in Bristol Bay, to everybody. And people, you know, but there weren't a lot of real conflicts at that point. You know, there weren't obviously management conflicts. Some, probably the closest really would have been Chat and the Caribou, which were in poor shape at that time.
We're down
low at that time. A lot of interest and, you know, concern about the land use actions. I mean, the park, creation of parks and refuges and sort of ongoing stuff about that. And things like wolf management was, okay. It was a thing, because Dillingham was a spot where there were a number of guys who flew and shot wolves from the air and hunted wolves and stuff. So I got to know some of them, you know, as part of that. But that wasn't really, you know, it wasn't really a direct relationship. That was more in terms of the subsistence stuff. Although some of those people were people that were interested in, game management activities.
You had asked about the reception to Steve's presence. That you were talking about how those fish and game biologists who were already there received him.
Yeah.
I was also wondering about how the community received you being there and the idea that their hunting and fishing was now being documented. And you know, you knocked on somebody's door to talk to them. Were you allowed in?
Yeah. I think because of the way I kind of started it out, it really wasn't knocking on too many people's doors early on. It was talking to, you know, going to a community, finding some people to talk to, explain what we were doing, especially the first year or so. So it really was kind of trying to get a sense of the lay of the land and who's who, and then that usually would lead into conversations with knowledgeable people in the community, going to a steam bath with people, and you know, and talking. I'm thinking of especially up the Nooshigak River was kind of that. I think maybe a little bit like the fish and game guys, people kind of say, well, subsistence fish, you know, we all care about these, you know, harvest the local fish, and yeah, you're interested in that, and so, you know, so it wasn't, there really wasn't, I don't recall really suspicion or, you know, or concern about that at that, especially at that early phase. That there might have been more of that later on with certain things, but yeah, it was more like, you know, hey, we're doing this stuff, you know, and you're a young guy interested in this stuff, and you know, and we're willing to share a little bit with you about our, you know, about what we do and how we do it. So that side of it was really, you know, fairly, it wasn't in your face, and I think partly because it wasn't. I guess that was kind of the advantage of Lonner's theory of it, was you're trying to figure out what works in a particular place, and so the kinds of questions and the kinds of issues that I would look at in the Nooshigak communities was, of course, way different than going down to King Salmon and Naknek, and places where, you know, there had been much more of a commercial economy and not nearly the same kind of traditional activities. But again, people were generous. I mean, people were, you know, show up in a place and people helped to find a place to stay and and oh, you talk to somebody, you know, who may or may not have been really active in this, but they'd say, well, you really should be talking to so and so, and you know, and then mm-hmm. you sort of track that out. And
did you go over to Togiak early on?
Not real early on. Let me think.
That might have been a little different.
It was different. It was way different. And it was, and I knew it was way different because that's what I heard from people. So I was reluctant to get the, because Fish and Game had, you know, had active stuff with Walrus Eye, with, you know, mm-hmm. the Walrus management. And so, yeah, and so that was, you know, so talking to people about that. I did, actually, the first time I went to Togiak was a, what was it? I got on somebody's fishing boat. It was during the herring fishery, and I went over on a boat, and I was and I wasn't really in control of things very much. I mean, I was basically going along, you know, with these guys, this fishery. So I wound up anchoring off some of the other islands, not Walrus Island, but that other set of islands.
Summit.
Yeah, what are they?
I'm forgetting
the names. Yeah, but the ones closer to Togiak, out from Togiak, which was also kind of mind-boggling to me because there had been, you know, quite a lot of pot hunting in those places. There was a lot of, I mean, you could tell there was a lot of archaeology in this area.
Quote-unquote archaeology,
Yeah, that there was a lot of stuff out there. So that was quite interesting to me, just as a past, from my past life of archaeology, but and then so that was kind of a broad introduction to Togiak, and then I think maybe didn't really go over to Togiak until Molly started working for us, which I don't remember exactly when that would have been, but it was maybe a year into things, or mm-hmm. maybe some point in there that hired Molly Chithluck. And that was a smart thing for the Subsistence Division to do, to try and figure out how to bring some local folks into work. And I guess that was kind of a priority of Lonner's that he.
Yeah, so he wrote about that. So how did you find Molly, or did she find you, or how did that happen?
And she was from Dillingham.
Electnagik.
Her husband's family, I think, was originally from Dillingham, right?
Joe's. Did you see the picture of his dad on the back out
here? Yeah, I did.
I think she was recommended by somebody at Fish and Game who said, and I don't know what her connection was. Or it may have been a friend of somebody, you know, somebody that somebody else at Fish and Game knew, and that was, that was a real lift to pull her.
Absolutely, and especially for Togiak, because I suspect in that boat that you were in for herring, they were mostly just talking in Yupik, right?
Because that
was a 100% Yupik speaking community until fairly recently, you couldn't do any real meaningful work in English there.
No. And I must have gone over to just a quick trip once where I sort of got that real sense. maybe had coffee in somebody's house or something, but really hard to do anything. And we never really did that much in Togiak. When I was there, we really didn't do that much in Togiak. You know, it was basically trying to just get entree and same thing with Manakotik. Didn't really. But with Manakotik, there was enough coming and going and contact that I really kind of got to meet folks there. And Molly and others had good connections. There too.
So what was your first then formal project that you did once you were sort of getting your feet on the ground and meeting people?
I think it was a summary of the subsistence fishery stuff, because that seemed like a good starting point since there was data, and I think it was basically trying to cast, you know, take the data that existed and try to cast it into something that was a little more, provided the bigger picture.
Yeah, this is permit data that Cobb Fish had been collecting for a while.
Yeah. And it was variable, but it was quite a bit for most of the major communities. And then I think trying to get some sense of what was permitted and what, you know, what people were responding to. And then I think one of the other things, as I was kind of doing these, you know, this reconnaissance, you know, in different parts, was to get a sense, because of course mostly the permitted data was mostly salmon, it was going to be salmon.
Yeah.
So, but there were all these other fisheries that people were, you know, were using, whitefish and other fisheries. So I think that was the other thing I was trying to do, was get a sense of that as a, you know, just what stocks and what, mm-hmm. you know, who was using what other kind of species. So I kind of vaguely remember, so I think, I don't remember why, but I do remember, maybe it was even report to the board.
Yeah, I was going to ask, did this wind up going to the board?
I think, it might have been kind of one of those things where it was kind of, and I think it would have been 1980 probably, this would have been that first year that I was there, that I wound up putting together some background stuff that I assume was just, I think maybe there's a way to just kind of ease the subsistence division into, or maybe we were still a section at that point. I can't remember.
Yeah, we're still a section. Yep.
So I think maybe I went to a board meeting and kind of presented some background, you know, just as part of the Comfish stuff, you know, providing
sort
some
of information.
Yeah, just kind of, yeah. Here's.
But you don't remember the experience?
No, I really don't. I think it kind of just blurs in with all of the board stuff that happened later.
Maybe if it was a lousy experience, you probably would remember.
But if
you gave the report and it was just sort of next.
I think that's how I picture it. Yeah, that it was really, this is kind of, you know, just kind of odd, but this is a new, you know, this is a new thing. So the board was kind of trying to figure out, and it probably was before any of the Bristol Bay wasn't part of the crisis stuff that was going on, so wasn't Cook Inlet or someplace. So I think that probably helped. So I don't think it would. Yeah, that's kind of what I picture would be, just sitting next to whoever the Comfish rep was there, and they probably, and of course, like I say, at that point they were, that's kind of what they were thinking the subsistence section was going to do, do subsistence fishery.
I want to come back to that, our relationship with the permit system, but before we do that, I want to talk more about your, because I know of at least two other projects that you did out there, because you soon were doing a survey up in Non-Dalton,
right.
how did that all happen?
I think that I realized that wanted to dig in more depth, and since I had some basic starting point in Non-Dalton, it seemed like a good place to start. And the other thing was, at that point, I think by that time the division was really kind of wrestling with how to characterize subsistence economies. I mean, you know, so it was starting to, and I remember holding Bob Wolf's dissertation and thinking, well, okay, we got, you know, I sort of had the background, the mapping background, you know, I sort of understood, had an idea about what you might do in terms of land use mapping, but I didn't really know much about how you quantify and characterize the, you know, the economics and cultural side, but the economic, I think there was kind of a push to to figure out how to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And Bob's dissertation was kind of a, you know, it was a, not exactly a roadmap, but it was a, you know, it was
a model.
Yeah, a model. And so that's, so I kind of tried to do, you know, take what I knew of Don Dalton and try to go and collect some of, you know, some parallel kinds of information.
But how did you know about Wolf's dissertation?
I'm not sure. I think I certainly wasn't provided by folks up at the upper levels. That's a good question. I actually tried to remember how that came about. I guess partly because of my academic interest, I was spending a lot of time thinking about, you know, looking for models, thinking about how to do the mm-hmm. stuff, and had seen, you know, I'd seen Canadian stuff, you know, so I mm-hmm. looked at Peter Usher's stuff, and mm-hmm. you know, and had mm-hmm. had looked at, you know, other models, and so yeah, so somebody must have told me about Bob's or say,
it didn't come from Lonner.
No, I'm sure it didn't. There really, it was very little that specific stuff that really came from headquarters on that kind of stuff.
Really?
They didn't provide guidelines for how to do a project?
Not as I recall. Or again, as I said, very broad. Very mm-hmm. broad, which was kind of, yeah, kind of this. I mean, as I recall, it seemed like Tom Lonner's approach was, see what's there. try to make sense. Yeah. You know, try to come up with. I mean, he really, yeah, he didn't impose. It wasn't some sort of top-down model of how this stuff worked.
Not top-down. Yeah. That's it. So you had Wolf's dissertation. You saw the quantitative, in part, the quantitative approach that he had taken, and then you then decided, well, I know Non Dalton. I know the people up there. Let's try this out.
That's really what happened. Of course, I also had kind of Dick Nelson's model. I mean, sort of, you know, I sort of do, you know, participant observation kinds of stuff. But it was clear that wasn't going to be, because the other thing going on was trying to figure out, you know, what's going to be useful for management purposes, and I was talking to managers, but mm-hmm. but again, there may have been general direction from Lonner and Cunningham down to say, well, you know, figure out what's going on in your region with management issues and figure out some information that can be useful, you know, to people. But again, it was quite broad, especially, I mean, those first, which is probably not too surprising, because those guys didn't know anything about fish and game. Well, Paul did. Paul came out of the mm-hmm. out of the fisheries management stuff. But so I think they kind of threw us out there to provide them with some data about how to make this thing.
Which isn't a bad way to start.
Yeah,
I mean, if you don't really know what's going on, you don't go in with a real specific agenda or data gathering tool. You talk to people and listen and So how did you then launch the Non Dalton project?
Because
this is actually in our timeline,
right,
Bill and Karen, because. Because, just as background, I'm interested in this because this might have been the very first household harvest survey that the program ever did.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been the first one.
I suppose it might have been.
It's interesting that you had Bob Wolf's dissertation in hand because he was a pioneer of that approach.
Yeah. And where was he at that time? Because I'd never met him.
I think he finished his dissertation in about 79 or so. And he then, in 80 or 81, went back with funds that came from what was then, I think, part of BLM, but became MMS and BOEM, and did additional research using the survey methods and came up with a technical paper and then was hired in early 82. But he might have actually, in those couple years you're talking about, been down at UCLA or wherever it was he was.
Right.
He was teaching.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So how did, what did, yeah. what did you do then?
Yeah.
You designed a form, right? You designed some kind of data collection form.
Yeah, and pretty, you know, probably very, and I'm making this up to some extent because I'm trying to reconstruct I doubt I have anything left in my, I doubt that I saved anything. Well, actually, no, that's not true. There's a box up there that I didn't look at about Non-Dalton and that I thought was mostly earlier stuff that I'd done, but it may have included some of that. But anyway... Yeah, I think I went into the community, talked to the, you know, some of the people who I'd known around there, talked about what I wanted to do, identified a kind of a set of people that I knew were harvesting stuff, because it was, you know, because they're pretty diverse, a lot of different things are going on in Non-Dalton. And I'm pretty sure I did have some kind of a simple for, you know, harvest type form, and I took what, because it would have been some permit data, so I probably, you know, I sort of took that as a starting point, tried to compare that with what, you know, it really was kind of a key informant approach to it, because I'm pretty sure I didn't try to do a household, you know, full household.
Like a census sample.
Yeah. I didn't try to do
it. More focused on harvesters.
Yeah. I do remember one, I remember a cross check that I thought was quite interesting. I had somebody take me up to the dump and looked at carcass, because there was a lot of stuff, there were bones and carcasses of stuff in the dump, and I remember asking people about that because like there were caribou carcasses there, and I wasn't hearing anything about caribou harvest from people, but there was the other, you know, there was the evidence, or people weren't telling me about harvesting caribou, and so that would led me to then ask more questions about where people were going, because it wasn't real straightforward. I mean, I think even though I had the relationship, it wasn't real easy to get people to talk about that more detailed level of harvest.
And like you say, Mulchatna was low then, so there probably were restrictions on how many caribou people could take, or when they could take them.
Yeah, that's very likely.
It's my impression too that that Non-Dalton study, you sort of demonstrated that it wasn't only about being able to get out and hunt and fish, it was also having the ability to process and store, so kind of expanded the idea of what subsistence was about, right? That it's an economy and a way of life or something.
Well, I think that was part of the, I was trying to put it in context, you know, put it in context of how life, you know, what life was like and how people were making a living, and of course, because a big factor was in subsistence stuff was people leaving to go commercial fishing in the summertime in the years they could when there was good fishing, so that was a constraint and the limitations on the economics, the snow machines, and you know, getting access to other areas. That was also an interest of mine, because that was actually part of what my thesis was about, was the impact of, or the sort of speculative impact of land use change, like non-native settlers, you know, taking up prime locations that people had traditionally used, and talking about the impact of that, which was real. I mean, people didn't want to go use some of those areas with somebody looking over their shoulder, so I think that was part of the context for But again, it was partly, it was a lot of inspiration from Bob's dissertation of trying to look at the...
Fit into his thing about, you know, that, what is it, the richest people...
Not necessarily the richest.
Well, the ones who hunt the most.
Yeah.
Versus, and how they share it, isn't it something in that context?
And that was really that was a really obvious thing going on in Dalton, like lots of places. I mean, pretty wide range of economic circumstances and cultural connection, you know, sort of people, there were people with new places and wanted, you know, went back for a lot of reasons, you know, so partly because they, you know, had connections, you know, had traditional connections to those places, family connections and stuff.
And you were up there on your own?
Yeah.
And were you living there during that survey period?
You must have stayed up there for a
I
while.
I stayed up there. I don't remember exactly how. I stayed with some people at different points. And then I think I probably, because I had friends up in Lake Clark, so I probably circulated back and forth to stay up there too with people.
Were there people there that just wouldn't talk to you?
Yeah, it must have been, and I think it might have been two-way. I mean, it was, you know, I feel like I just
didn't want to lock it,
for different connections. But again, it was, and it was interesting because there had been some, there was a key family who, there'd been some domestic violence in the, you know, and so I was relying on them, but I was also very, nervous about the son had knifed somebody or something.
I remember some of that.
So it was, and one of the interesting things, and Jim, you've probably seen this in other places too, but like some of the more, some of the most traditional households were kind of almost ostracized. I mean, there were some, you know, interesting dynamics in the community. So there were some households, and they were, you know, they were, well, Bobbies. I mean, they were Blind Village.
Yeah, they're really non-village people.
And who see, you know, who I think liked talking to me and shared a lot of traditional information and knowledge with me, but didn't get along with their neighbor, who, you know, people stealing firewood and treating people bad, you know, old people badly, you know, different things like. So it was like all that kind of stuff. It was pretty complicated to maneuver your way through.
Well, that's why I sort of the village politics and how that helped or hindered your work.
So I never, you know, I wouldn't, it'd be interesting to know how. Because I never really didn't have a chance to follow in detail some of the later household survey stuff, you know. But
yeah, we'll get into that. But this was I think the first. And what I remember when I was hired, I think you were still analyzing the information. This was early 81, as I recall, and this is when Bob was back, and I remember sitting in on a discussion that you and Bob had comparing his findings from that MMS study with yours and the incredible similarities in some of the patterns, including the specialization and including the super households and so forth.
Okay.
You wrote up the technical paper.
Right.
Well, and it's interesting, I thought a lot of the early work in the division, the section was sort of, you know, more qualitative, ethnographic. So the idea that early on you were doing survey work.
Well, again, I think I was trying to, you know, I was trying to figure out how to, I mean, it was two problems. One was how to characterize what really was going on in these places as opposed to just, you know, picking, counting fish harvest or something. But the other one was, how to think about how to enter, you know, how it would relate to management stuff and how, you know, what, because I think that the, and I may have downplayed, I mean, I may have misspoke a little bit about Tom Lawner and Paul's oversight of that. I mean, I think because they were encouraging us to, you know, to figure, to well, just what we said earlier, yeah. to figure out how to do that stuff, yeah. And I think that really was because they, you know, we could have imposed some, you know, some top down type of protocols and stuff, but they were smart enough to realize they didn't know enough about what that would be.
Well, and they also trusted, they hired people who were experienced and knowledgeable in their fields and trusted you guys, you know what you were doing.
Yeah.
Now, I know the other, there might have been more, but the other field project that you were really involved in there was the Regional Guides Mapping Project. Yeah. Yeah. And that was after both Molly and John Wright and Judy Morris too.
No,
I think Judy might have come a little bit later. But anyway, and that built probably upon your earlier experience in Canada. Isn't it? So there was this mapping project. Maybe
talk about what that project was.
Yeah, because that was mapping has always been a key component of the of the program.
Yeah.
And you went to virtually every place.
I think that really did develop as we got kind of more resources, and I mean, it was something that interested me all along. But I think probably started sketching that out when I was doing my, I mean, just sort of getting that. Well, in fact, I had forgotten I had worked in King Sam because I did a, as part of that cooperative studies stuff, I had done some stuff in Katmai.
Oh, for Katmai.
For Katmai, yeah. As well. So I had been to, I had forgotten, so I had been to, so I kind of had a little bit of a picture of some of the land use stuff, at least in those communities, and which would have been up to Quijac as well, because we've been looking at Igiagig and Levelock and those places too. But let me just give
some background for the. The Department of Fish and Game, I don't know exactly where the funding came from, but it launched this regional guides project. And it divided the state into five or six regions and was trying to summarize, this is the habitat division, was trying to summarize available information about fish, wildlife, and human use of resources. And so the division, or might have been the section, but where it got funding to do basic field work, because most of the human use information in rural places was missing. And one of the key features of the regional guide were maps. And these are physical maps back then. And so we got funding to go to communities to interview people to map where they were hunting and fishing. And the overall goal was to protect fish and wildlife habitat and provide information that the habitat biologists could use in evaluating permit applications and commenting on federal land use plans and so forth. So,
when do you think that got started?
Well, I think it was probably about 81, 82, somewhere in there, because as I recall, I'm pretty sure it was 1983 at the Alaska Anthropology meeting that you described some of the findings of that mapping project and had the maps up on the wall and we're talking about them. So the field work must have come like in 81, 82.
Yeah.
I think I had been hired when you were still doing some of the field work.
Okay, Because I think it was, I mean, I guess the way I picture it was really because I don't really remember a whole lot of detail about that, except that it seemed like a logical outgrowth. You know, so whoever got the funding, and the which really was what enabled probably hiring
John
and some of those extra.
I think Judy might have come with the ANILCA funding later.
So that was like a whole big step up in terms of what we
were. It makes sense when you're doing subsistence documentation that you would map it. I mean, you said people were going out to traditional places, and so it does make sense that it would connect in.
And then this program allowed for doing that much more systematically, and instead of the few places where, you know, the limited stuff that we were able to do.
Yeah, so how did you carry out that work? We'd go to a community and sit down with the hunters and mark up maps?
I think,
that was it. Yeah.
At that point, I think we really were starting to get a little more systematic about reaching out to the other organizations and communities. I think, so there was kind of a phase of, you know, more formal outreach would have been happening by that point, and then sending John and sending, you know, doing
Molly must have been involved too.
Molly would have been involved in quite a lot of that, especially in the UP areas. It was also a very nice way for a new employee like John to sort of get their feet on the ground doing it, because they got kind of did what kind of replicated what I'd done starting out of getting out and meeting people. And
just a quick question, when you mentioned Molly, is that Molly Cleeflet or Molly McCannon?
Molly Chiflet.
Molly Chiflet. So that's the main thing. So I think then I think that was, of course, we had developed better relations. By that point, we had developed better relations with BBNA and with other community organizations. So that was, it was more formal then to go in. And again, it was, you know, it was key informant kinds of things. And I had had, like, because I had done that in for the Katmai, and for
Canada,
Mount Dalton, and right. Canada, so we had a start in the Bristol Bay Area, but then basically just started systematically dividing up, you know, going to, and I, part of the reason I think I'm having a little trouble is I think some of that must have carried over to when I actually came down here.
That's right.
Because I don't really remember Pilot Point. I never got down to some of those communities.
Molly and John, guys did that.
Even Judy was involved in some of the late stages of that, because I think she came in 82, I think.
Is Judy Morris.
Judy Morris, was stationed in King Salmon. Steve hired her, and that was in Ilka money. But but you're right, because that meeting that I referred to at the Alaska Anthropological Association, you had recently accepted the job as director. So that was like February, March of 83, because Denny had moved up to deputy commissioner. And so that established for the division some of the mapping methodologies that we later used. Of course, those have evolved a whole lot since then. So let's go back to this expectation that you mentioned when you walked into the Fish and Game office, that you were now going to be in charge of the annual permit program. Because eventually that happened in Bristol Bay, and I think it was the first annual monitoring program that the division handled, and actually still, in to a large part, handled. So how did it then happen?
I don't remember that really, because what I remember was resisting being stuck in that. So basically, and my excuse was, well, we got this whole region, we got all these things to do, and so I actually don't. It must have happened after I left there.
Oh, you think so?
I think so. Because I don't think we. I mean, I know I didn't go out and do salmon surveys or handle the permitting stuff.
After you became director, the person who became overall responsible for that region was me. I certainly didn't I certainly wasn't asked about taking over the Perimeter. It was already happening.
So it was happening.
It was happening, and maybe Molly had some role in. Because she always played a big deal in that. So
yeah,
if you don't remember, you know, actually leading that, I just wonder how it happened. Because
what explain?
Yeah, well, in Bristol Bay, going way way back, anybody who wants to engage in the subsistence fishery had to get a subsistence permit at the beginning of the season that was free, and record on that permit your daily harvest of salmon by species, and send it in at the end of the year, and it still exists.
Yeah, yeah.
And the performance was spotty, and you know, I'm going to wonder if Molly will remember this, but because these systems, even in the best of times and the easiest communities, don't operate without some tender, loving care. And when I was responsible for that area, and Molly and John and Judy helped out too, and the administrative person that we had, we put in a lot of effort and outreach. We hired local people in every community to issue the permits,
uh-huh,
and to make phone calls at the end of the year to remind people to send them in. And we routinely achieved 90% or more.
Yeah.
But I'm interested. It's interesting that you don't remember that sort of handoff.
Well, maybe what I really remember was the initial phase, and then maybe, because then, like I say, by 1980, certainly had kind of, I mean, not about taken over, but we're definitely reporting on that. So
yeah.
Maybe it really did. Maybe that was a transition. We decided that it made sense to handle that. That could very well be. Yeah, I don't.
And actually, I don't remember in the very early years how we analyzed the information, but we wound up, because Confish must have done it before, but at some point all those permits started coming to us, and we did all the estimates, all the expansions, and then we handed it all over to Confish to put in their AMRs, but the 90% of it was done by us or by these people that we hired and paid for.
Right.
We still do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And quite frankly, the participation rates and so forth have dropped down since we don't have anybody sitting in Dillingham anymore. I mean, it was a matter of pride, actually, for Molly and for whoever was our local administrative person to achieve that 90%. And it, I don't want to exaggerate that, because it wasn't that hard. People would do it for the most part.
You'd
get the permits back, and they'd have fish blood on it. They'd be partially waterlogged and everything, because they'd kept them in their pocket.
Right.
But
are there other places in the state that subsistence permit like that is required?
Oh yeah, yeah. Most places to the south and east. Yeah, Bristol Bay is with some exceptions, the last big one. In the more remote Alaska, like you almost never needed a permit in Kuskokwim or the Yukon. You did in some of the Nome areas. It's more where there's developed commercial fisheries or a substantial non-local participation in the program. And in Bristol Bay, where there's a lot of commercial fishing and people coming in seasonally, that I think very early there was this need to document the subsistence fishery, which helped protect it, quite frankly.
Well, it was a way to keep track of numbers.
Not,
it wasn't you have permission or no permission to do it. It was just a way.
Well, you
to
had
keep
to have
track.
The permit,
right? Yeah. But it was a way to keep track of the numbers.
Yeah. Most that was what it was about.
It was a research tool.
Yeah,
right.
Wasn't an enforcement tool.
Yeah. Okay,
at least that's how I always explained it to people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if we get to talk to Molly, maybe she'll remember
send a question
to John.
Yesterday, you guys were talking about Lying Village and getting some work done there or something. Maybe you can expand on that.
Well, Lying Village was technically not in your area.
Right. It was outside was it?
Well, I recall, an early question was who's going to take responsibility for Lime
Village? Yeah. And I think So I had done that. So I had done a little bit of work there as part of this Park Service thing, and that's what we were talking about yesterday. And then I think it was after I became director, then we hired Priscilla Carey.
Yeah.
But I was involved in that project, I guess, somehow, because I
you'd been there
and something. Yeah,
something. Was something about Norm and somebody came and kind of.
Yeah, that was just before I was with Fish and Game. That was when I've been doing the park work.
Okay.
And that's when they were concerned, because that was information was being used to identify who qualified to
who was in the resident zones for the parks.
Yeah.
So it was
yeah.
Norman. I can't remember who the other person was.
Don Mitchell. Don Mitchell.
They came and heavy-handed you.
And I don't remember exactly what. Well, I guess there were some issues about moose and stuff in that upper Kuskokwim area. That may have been part of what went into the concern about Lyme Village. But the division contracted with an expert who.
So when Norm and Don came, did Lyme Village get included as a resident zone?
Yeah.
With your Lake Clark study?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I'm not quite clear how that happened, really. That was part of the congressional stuff. That
I'm just trying to remember whether those resident zone communities are named in ANILCA or whether it's more of a regulatory action.
I can't remember.
I think it's regulatory, but I could be wrong.
The Park Service somehow.
Because I'm wondering how those decisions got made. You had to prove you were a resident community. I don't know how the criteria were.
There had to be some evidence that historically, at least, your community had engaged in subsistence activities in the park preserve.
Right. Yeah. And so I was thinking that was done, like with your survey work, you know, those projects were done after the designation.
Oh, yeah.
To justify.
For the division. Yeah. Yeah.
No, for a CPSU or, you know, when the park boundaries were being determined and they had EISs. And it might have been in there. I mean, somebody had to do the historical research to show there was traditional use.
And that was the purpose of the
of what of you were
still,
doing.
What I was doing,
right?
Of course, yeah. Those studies, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, let's go to a slightly different topic. You mentioned your first board meeting was probably the one where you gave that overview of subsistence permit, but as a researcher. Do you remember other board meetings that you were there, whether there were specific issues that you were that you were involved in? Because I know you were involved in later ones, but I'm talking about some of the early ones when you were actually stationed in Dillingham. Did you give other board reports? Or?
Well, I did. I did one on traditional use of brown bear.
Oh, wow.
Which was, but I don't remember exactly why that. I think that must have been kind of.
That was to the Board of Game.
That was the Board of Game.
And how did?
Yeah.
How did it go? It was,
and of course, and I built off the non-Dalton stuff for that, but then broadened that to other. But I can't remember why. It's hard to imagine that there was a management issue about brown bear out in that part of the country. So I can't picture why.
I was wondering: is did you? Were you researching brown bear for a reason?
Yeah.
Was there a local proposal they wanted to hunt brown bear?
Well, yeah, that's maybe there was a management issue with restriction. You know, trying to restrict. Maybe there was a concern. Maybe there was a, you know, unless it was more a control. Brown bear control, but I don't think
it was that.
No,
I'm pretty sure back then in the early '80s, you could take a brown bear, and it might have been only once every 4 years, and you had to have it sealed.
That's right.
None of these things fit in with a subsistence hunting tradition,
right?
And in some ways, actually contradicted some of the traditions regarding how you treated the remains.
Yeah.
Or even talking about bears.
Yeah. So I think that's what it was. I think somewhere along the line, Tom or Paul or somebody said, well, we're going to have to start talking about what really goes on in these places. And maybe we should you know, Steve, you've been talking about these brown bear issues, and it probably was one I talked to Bob about too, because I'm sure that Bob and I talked about, you know, comparing Yupik and Tenaya, you know, views or something like that. And so I'm guessing, but we're just reconstructing that probably it was just a way to start putting some stuff in the record about, you know, in dealing with the board, that this is a use and it ought to be accommodated in some way, you know. And so it was a little, it caused a little stir.
Did it?
Yeah.
Describe that.
Well, just that, I can remember with game division folks, but it was more just that it was one of those things where lots of people knew it was going on, but talking about it, you know, and as if it were, you know, so I think so with the board, as I recall, I think I gave a report to the board of game, and I don't know what the context would have been, but and maybe I ought to go back and look at the report and see what. Maybe it actually did explain why.
Do you remember the response you got from the board of
games? It was, and I may be conflating this with other
later issues, but it was
kind of like, well, that's interesting, but I'm skeptical, you know, but I'm not sure I really believe what you're saying. You know, it was sort of skepticism, but of course there were people like Huntington, other people on there at the time who wouldn't have been shocked by, you know, so it was kind of, in fact, that's kind of what I almost remember about it. It was almost like it was a way for the division to establish some street cred that it really knew something about some of these things that were going on in, you know, in villages beyond the, you know, beyond the obvious. Yeah.
But did how did the villages feel about maybe some of this being publicized?
Yeah, well, I don't remember really any kind of, most people that would know about it wouldn't have been in those meetings and wouldn't have heard anything about it. It would have been their advocates and others who would have been at those at those board meetings, you know.
As I recall your findings, because I used them a lot when we dealt with the brown bear issue in the Chignik community, Chignik Lake, especially in Perryville, where they certainly were taking brown bear for subsistence. But in your findings, it wasn't as if even dozens of brown bear were being taken for subsistence. You could almost count the numbers on your fingers and maybe your fingers and toes.
Yeah.
It was a few in certain communities and for very specific purposes for the fat, and some people use the meat and so forth, and some hide maybe less so,
as I recall.
But the view of managers and the board was that, you know, they would say, well, you know, the brown bears, that's not a subsistence animal.
It's
not something people use or need or anything like that. And so there would be that skepticism about it. And you know, the brown bears had dollar signs attached to them. I mean, they're being managed mostly for trophy hunts.
But
so what you're saying is subsistence bears were being taken without following this state permit system.
That is correct.
At that time, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a minimal take.
I mean, it is interesting. It would be interesting to try to reconstruct that now that I've raised it, because I don't really.
When do you think that was? 1980, maybe?
80, 81.
Because I certainly wasn't at a game board meeting where you gave a report like that, so it had to be before I. Any other early board memories that you have?
No, because it really, when I was in Dillingham, there wouldn't have been many reasons. I think they brought us into some board meetings just to see what they were like. I mean, I think so. So, and I think that may have been kind of what this was, even, is to, you know, you're going to be there, you may as well give us, you know, you've got this interesting stuff, you may as well give a little report to the board. I mean, it
be visible. We're doing something, and then we can learn about some things that others can't.
Yeah. So I think that was kind of the theory, because there really weren't, you know, except for the fisheries stuff, and even there wasn't, like, management conflicts over subsistence going on.
Well, that leads to one of my questions, was how, you know, what field research, you got your assignments, you decided, I'm going to focus on Dalton, or I'm going to go talk about bears. That was your choice, and how those decisions get made?
Pretty much, because it was kind of minimal, like I say, minimal oversight. Lonner and Cunningham were down at Juneau, and
I just know if it's like, yeah, management issue comes up, and so you have to now go do a project on it.
I mean, that did happen.
That was what, I think that's what typically would, but there weren't that many,
Know,
and that probably is why. I mean, I'm trying to think about how we took over the permit stuff. It was kind of just a good way to be involved in it.
Well, yeah, that's how I explain it. Yeah. That there's a lot of advantages to doing something that everybody, and I mean just about everybody, is
involved,
in tune with,
yeah.
and agrees is valuable.
Well,
so when did Linda Alana then arrive on the scene? Because she must have had some early influence on methods and topics and so forth.
Yeah.
It's before me.
Yeah. I've been trying to remember that, and I was actually having trouble remembering. So
she was research director, wasn't she originally?
But that was after around the same time Denny came on board. I mean,
no, she was deputy director.
Deputy director. That's right. So.
Because think Cunningham was gone when Denny became director chief and Lana left, and I think my understanding was that Linda had moved from research director, which she couldn't have been in very long, to deputy director.
I have here in the timeline 82.
That's too late.
She became 82. She developed the technical paper series.
That's right.
Okay.
That is correct. But she was already deputy.
She was already there by then.
Yeah.
And when did Denny become director?
February of 81.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So you don't. Did you know Linda before?
No, you met
her on the job then.
Yeah, and it would have been very much. I can think of a small handful of meetings, you know, that were held in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
And probably one of those would have been her pulling in Dick Nelson and, you know, sort of like a training confab of some kind.
That was my first day on the job. It was the top of the Hilton, and it was Dick Nelson, Ray Bain, and Bob Wolf
were there, and the entire
subsistence staff, and me as a new person, and a lot of other
new,
very recently hired
people
like Judy Morris and Dave Mills and a bunch of others. And Linda was deputy director at that time, and there was no research director because Bob was still doing his, he was at that because I think he was just coming back from the field from that work that he did.
Okay.
And then he was hired as the research director and showed up in January.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the reason I bring it up is that you're saying that the early experience was that there was a lot of confidence in the staff and we didn't know a lot, and rather than come up with a survey form that everybody was ordered to administer in all these communities without any background, you were given leeway to learn and pick some things to look at and And then I thought maybe Linda showed up and started to maybe try to formalize. So these meetings that you talk about, what happened at, because besides the one that we were just talking about, the earlier ones, there must have been.
Well, I don't know that there were very many. I don't really remember. I think maybe remember coming in for some board meetings, and maybe there were discussions that went on with other staff, you know, with staff, but I really don't remember much in the way of direction. I think Linda was getting her feet on the ground and figuring out what was going on for some period of time there, and the technical paper series was really a valuable way to start pulling that together. But in terms of, so I think what I remember more about that would be, you know, as resources, then certainly Linda was, you know, somebody you could talk to about research issues, and you know, somebody that could provide more so than Paul or Tom had been, really. But of course, by that point, things were starting to shift into much more the politics and the subsistence stuff. And of course, so went Denny. I mean, that was, you know, we sort of had that first year of, it was almost like a grace period of starting up these things and getting going. And then things started to get pretty, you know, pretty intense. Backlash from
you're going the right department. Where I wanted to
we're
transitioning into you getting involved in those things, which eventually wound up making you director. So go ahead.
I don't really remember very many meetings, but one meeting that I really do clearly remember was us coming down to Juneau at the behest of, well, the whole thing that became the 35 proposals.
The repeal initiative?
This is before. That was happening, but he's talking about the 35 proposals that the Wildlife or then Game Division drafted to sort of force feed the subsistence law down the throats of everybody.
And I don't remember exactly the sequence, but certainly there had been discussions going on in the department about, so the initiative process had started, and the department, and particularly Ron Somerville, who as the game division director, basically was taking a very proactive approach to that, saying, well, if you're going to have a subsistence law, let's give them a subsistence law, and let's show how bad this is really going to be, because it's going to use up all the resources, and it's going to... So the Game Division drafted this set of proposals that were intended to go... And the division, I think, had been talking about... I mean, there was sort of a tension division about whether you took sort of a very incremental approach and just sort of, you know, dealt with issues as they cropped up, or whether you did this comprehensively, whether you did get the boards to, you know, adopt regulations that really accommodate subsistence and so forth. So we were preempted in that by the Division of Game deciding, well, they're gonna go to the, I guess that was really just the game board. Go to the game board and really show what subsistence implementation would look like. And so it went through regionally and by species and said, I think they did a survey internally. How much moose would it take to accommodate, you know, people who live in, you know, this unit and these different units? And they did some sort of exercise like that. So then we...
Without us.
So then
what were these proposals? What were they proposing to the board to limit these?
It would be something effect in unit 14. It would take X hundred of moose, X hundred thousands of caribou to accommodate
subsistence users
or something.
And then were they proposing, therefore, that subsistence should be limited? Or they didn't go that far?
No, they were saying that's what it would take to become, and would that allow other uses? What other uses, you know, would that allow? And I don't remember the phrasing exactly.
Yeah, I don't remember whether they were proposing like permit conditions, but the overall result, as I recall, was rather severe restrictions on what they considered to be non-subsistence uses.
Yeah,
So it was designed to make people angry.
And so we, and of course, I think a lot of subsistence staff probably didn't really know much about what was going on, but we got called down to a meeting in Juneau by Denny to basically say, well, let's give these guys, you know, let's provide some, what do we know about, you know, what this is and how it compares with the, so it was really sort of a effort to counter what the game division was doing. So came down and there was a big confab with game division, which wasn't really, it started out sort of, as I remember, it was quasi-substantive. I mean, we had discussions about some regions and what we knew and what the game division knew. It would have, I think, probably the game division supervisors were there.
Yeah.
So we were sort of like in this big room together, kind of talking about these things. But it really, you know, it was structured, at least to begin with, as a discussion between game division and the subsistence division. But it fairly quickly devolved into what it was, which, yeah, you're just trying to cram this stuff down people's throats and make this look as bad as possible. And we've got alternative, you know, our approach would be, let's address these things with data and as the issues come up, and which did kind of push us into that incremental approach that probably later became a problem in some ways because we weren't able to look at it comprehensively and address them. But So that was
in 81?
That was in 82.
82, okay.
That was like January, February of 82, as I recall.
Yeah.
Because the board meeting was happening in sort of March or April. And this was headline-grabbing stuff.
Yeah.
Literally.
And the... So did that lead into that thing that the whole thing with the signatories? Was that after that then?
That was after that.
And
the 35 is just coincidence. Totally.
Yeah.
But for me, because I was at that meeting, that was, I think, the first time that I really saw some of the conflicts and differences between staff really come out in the open. And what I remember very vividly about that meeting was it turned in to this one-on-one debate between Kelso and Somerville about what the subsistence law meant and how to implement it and whether it was constitutional and all these kinds of things. And it was, it got down to the nitty gritty. And we all just sat there and watched, as I recall.
Yeah.
Well, and Denny being a lawyer, I'm sure he had.
He held his own, but Somerville was not a weak opponent either.
And Somerville was such a smart guy. He was a smart guy who knew. I mean, he had a great grasp of his division and what was going on. And he was a well spoken and kind of charismatic.
And of course the hunting community loved him.
So we were lucky we had Denny at that point to counter that a little bit.
Was Somerville's view common throughout the Fish and Game Department, and you felt that as staff, or was he the rarity?
No, he focused it. It was, I think that it started out much more, because people didn't really know what, you know, subsistence was sort of a, I mean, I think it was sort of a, people at early on didn't see it as that much of a threat. They would see it as collected data on the harvest, you know, on Citizens Fisheries harvests or other things. But so he was able to sort of construct the view that this was a threat to, mm-hmm. you know, to the status quo and to hunters. And he was very, you know, he was a real good spokesman for that. And sort of, so there were certainly other people in the department, in the division of game particularly, who saw that, and they reinforced each other and so forth. But he was really the, you know, the spokesman and the...
Yeah, and it's hard to say within the department just where everybody yeah. landed. I think a lot of people didn't pay attention at all. My view is that in the fisheries divisions, a lot of people, especially those who had been in rural places, were generally supportive of the subsistence law.
Yeah.
Habitat division, almost without exception, really saw what we were doing as a tremendous advantage for them in protecting mm-hmm.
yeah.
resources and so forth.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah.
And then, and not the entire game division wasn't hostile either. It was yeah. really a mixed bag, but that's where the focus yeah. Right. of a lot of it was. But Steve, one thing you might not remember is that after that meeting, you and I and Bob Wolf stayed on with Denny to write the memo that I have somewhere in my pile here
okay.
that came up with an alternative to yeah. doing this all at once, and it basically was the incremental
yeah.
approach to things.
Yeah. I can kind of remember, yeah. but I don't. Yeah,
and I mean, one would have to dive into the record on this, but at the meeting, did you attend the game board meeting then, where these were
yeah,
kicked around?
Yeah. Yeah, I think
because
so.
I think almost without exception, they all went down
yeah,
to defeat, yeah. and I don't remember whether part of it was the Department of Law then coming out and say, you really don't have to do this.
Yeah. I don't remember how that...
So by the incremental approach, you mean you guys, the subsistence division, would address issues as they came up,
from the
management
public.
Conflicts, whatever.
Yeah, that we were really relying on the people themselves, the communities themselves, to bring proposals mm-hmm. before the board that that pointed out issues with regulations, and then if we had information, we yeah. would apply that, right. and if not, we would do some of these more directed studies to.
But you didn't have to solve it for the whole state all
at
once,
right?
And then make a lot of people mad
in the right. absence of real data about
yeah.
those things. I mean, that was
right.
kind of the pitch that we would make
yeah.
as part of it. That
yeah.
yeah that,
because you look through the record, and even then, there was still a lot of talk about the subsistence user as opposed to subsistence uses. And
yeah.
and I think there still was this view that you could come up with a set of individual criteria that you would create a subsistence hunt and then require permits and have people apply. And, you know, if they
yeah.
lived in a local community, it wasn't a rural community, if they'd eaten moose for 20 years and their granddaddy did too, that
yeah.
they would get in, but somebody else would not.
Yeah.
And we, of course, and Lonner started this,
yeah.
you know, rejected that individual approach at the tier, unless
first.
You got down to tier two.
Yeah. That, I think that's something that really
yeah.
I have to give Lonner credit for, was really
absolutely.
Articulating that
yeah.
so yeah mm-hmm. so clearly. And I think that, yeah, because it would have been, If it had been somebody else running that thing, it could very easily have just gone to that approach of an individual
yeah.
welfare
yeah.
kind of, you know, kind of approach to the thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, even
mm-hmm.
despite the law, say,
yeah.
indicating it shouldn't, but, yeah.
Well, let's then talk a little bit about the initiative process, what you remember as a department employee going through that, which heated up in August and September of
'82. Right.
You were still out in Dillingham.
I was out in Dillingham, although I think I got pulled into some other things by Denny on that. I think respond, maybe even helping. Like,
oh yeah,
the thing
you, I think it was you and I and Bob again.
Yeah,
We met with Denny after the 35 signatory memo came out, and
yeah.
we and Linda too. Let's not forget Linda. She was important in this.
Right,
and we sat down and we talked about how to counter the seven arguments that were in that in that memo.
Right.
And it took Denny a while to actually finish the response, which is like 20 pages. Oh, you found it.
Yeah, I saw it in my stuff that I did.
It was a masterful piece of work, finally, that countered very effectively all seven of those points.
Right. But probably more importantly than the stuff that he actually wrote about it was then, and I wasn't part of this, but then there was just a whole lot of discussion between him and other advocacy, you know, the advocates, so, the, you know, AFN, and I don't really know much about what that was exactly, but it, mm-hmm. and it included, you know, elected officials and the people who...
Well, one thing that I wanted to ask you about is that one of the seven arguments that memo developed for repealing the law was, quote unquote, the division of subsistence. Mm-hmm. And in a couple of pages, it leveled a bunch of accusations. And among others, it said that the division refused to help with harvest data collection for the most part, that it was largely an advocacy group for a particular user group, and that it really didn't have a commitment to sound fish and game management. Where do you think all that came from?
Well, having resisted some of the harvest stuff early on.
Yeah,
okay.
and of course, Lonner did too.
But that, as you point out, that wasn't really the case. I think it was people making up reasons to oppose. I don't think there was any validity to those things.
Were there any cases early on from any of the staff or so forth that, you know, stepped across the line or with so-called advocacy? There had to be.
Yeah.
That'd be something.
Well,
because it's easy enough to do, right? If you're really passionate about what you're doing, you like the people you work with, you want to implement the law, you can see how that could be twisted.
Yeah. I suppose just talking about brown bear use could have been considered that way by some people who wanted to do that. I mean, I know there were people like I'm sure that's how Hinman saw. So all that may have been later on. I'm not sure how much that was at that point in time. But, I mean, I think just anybody talking about this stuff and represent and saying there's these other uses, it's so easy to twist that kind of stuff and interpret
stuff. Yeah, there was some racism going on too. You're advocating for the Native people's use, and what about us?
Yeah.
Other hunters.
I mean, and at a certain point, as it developed, I mean, I think some of those folks in, especially the game division, you know, just saw that there was a, you know, that this was, it was treading on their turf. It was, you know, it was. Mm-hmm. It was questioning their judgment about stuff. It was, you know, it was just a whole string of those things. And that discussion about the 35 proposals would have confirmed it for them say, hey.
Yeah, that we're not in control anymore.
Somebody's
actually going to ask some questions about what you're doing. And they didn't like it.
So I think that just the existence of the subsistence division would have, I mean, no matter what it was doing, would have, to some extent, raised those things at some point.
But as Denny pointed out in the memo, maybe most of the accusations in the response to the memo were simply just not true. And, you know, one of the things that, because I reread this the other day, they keep pointing at Tyonek, right, and the King Salmon fishery, and how this was an assault on sound management, and just if this is the way things are going to go, then everything's going to go to hell, and nobody's going to have a opportunity to fish or hunt anymore. And as Denny pointed out, the department had already said that a harvest could occur. So this argument that, you know, allocating good. A few thousand king salmon to Tyonek was somehow contrary to to management, that, it was just false. It was just false on its face. And there were other examples of
But you were in Dillingham at this time, right? Still,
yeah.
And this was going on. What was the sense in the community? This repeal initiative. Did people know about it? And
I'm
what
sure
the
they knew about
sentiment?
It in Dillingham.
Yeah. I think that I actually don't really I think I was getting sucked into the statewide stuff enough by that point in time that I wasn't even really paying that much attention to Dillingham itself. although the people that the Robin Samuelsons and the people who, you know, certainly were understood what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a set of, you know, people involved with
fair sophistication.
Yeah. So,
well, yeah, just, you know, how much the word got out,
in those days
about something like that.
Yeah. So there was, you know, there was people paying attention. And
I think Rural CAP here, in Anchorage, did a great job in outreach and getting the vote out.
Yeah.
Okay. Norm was, of course, involved in that. And others, and I think that showed in the final result.
Results, of opposition to it, yeah. I was going to say that. So at some point in there, then, and maybe it was part of what you were talking about with Bob and me and others. There was a discussion about subsistence as self-limiting to some extent. So that was kind of drawn out of the research then of showing. It's not just this, this infinite demand that people are taking what they, what they need, what they use, because that was kind of the other thing. People in the opposition were saying, well, this is just going to become part of the ever-growing demand, commercialization, other things that they were, saying would happen as a result of all this. And so that looking at the data, Bob's data about whatever data we had, really, I think we were drawing on the quantitative data to say, well, here, especially stuff that was long, where we had some years of.
So you were saying that like your data from Non Dalton and Bob Wolf's data would show that subsistence is self-limiting and all these worst case scenarios that the game division was throwing out there were unlikely.
That's right.
So that shows the importance of your work and subsistence division's work.
Yeah, and I think also the importance that here are people within the Department of Fish and Game who observe these things and are testifying, and they're trained as scientists. And of course, in the memo, we were just claimed to be just social scientists and nothing about biology. And as Kelso pointed out, well, maybe that's partially true, but it's social science that we need here.
Right.
We need people who are trained in these things who can learn from people about how they actually live.
Right.
So,
yeah.
One last thing before we move on to your second phase of employment. Were you involved in the joint board meetings where compliance with ANILCA was debated? That was in December of 81, I think, and then the spring of 82. I don't know whether you played any role in that.
I don't think I did. I think I had input on, when the Bob and Linda's, the analysis that they had done of the, whatever it was called, what is that report? The urban rural.
That's a little later.
That's later. Okay. Yeah. No, I wasn't. Yeah. I don't think I was involved in those. Okay.
There's their resource use in socioeconomic systems case.
Yeah, that's
studies.
Later. That's later. Yeah.
That was in 83.
That's still implementation of the law, but it's really anticipating the rural urban definitions and boundaries and so. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so let's then.
Yeah, so how did you become director? That was in 83, right?
Was it kicking and screaming?
Yeah, from Dillingham.
That's right, all the way from Delaware.
They sucked you out? What did they do?
Yeah. Well, I think I had had enough, you know, I'd been involved in these various discussions and respected Denny so much and saw, you know, saw. So when he got elevated and they're looking for a director, I again, I don't really remember very much about it, except, and I don't think I was that hesitant. I think it intrigued me that, you know, that there, and I guess I saw it as part of the whole project of trying to translate between these different systems of, you know, sort of, and I guess I had seen, being involved in those things earlier, I'd seen that I had something to contribute in terms of knowing something about, you know, what went on in rural Alaska, and
I have to interrupt with an important local question. Okay, wait.
All right, so we are back from our little break here. Bill, before we move into Steve talking more about being the director, did you have any other questions related to the earlier things we were talking about and his work as a researcher?
No, I do have a general question, but I'll ask it after he talks about being a director.
Okay. So we'll continue on with where we were going about how you became the director and why you were, that was appealing to you.
Well, Larry was quite right that, just thinking about it, that working with this group of people on this issue and this very intense thing was particularly appealing, I think, in contrast to being out in Dillingham and not having kind of a real team of people, although by that point we had hired a couple of people, but it was appealing, the idea of having, being part of this thing that was going on, and because by that point I'd gotten to know Linda and Denny and mm-hmm. and worked with you guys, and so yeah, so I think that definitely was an appealing factor.
Larry mentioned the word alliance. What's that in reference to?
Well, it's just this group of people working on this issue together. I mean, that's what, at least that's how I interpret what she she said. That because it was quite intense. I mean, it was, you know, trying to figure out how to counter the, you know, all this stuff about, you know, how terrible this business was, and the opportunity to try and figure out how to characterize, how to make this law work, you know, how to overcome these hurdles. So that was, yeah, so it was an interesting group of people and interesting challenge.
It kind of pulled you into the policy
side
versus the research side.
Yeah, yeah.
And so were you approached and asked to apply, or did you apply by choice? I don't know how it works if you apply to become a director.
I think somebody contacted me and said, "Hey, Steve, we think you should be director." I'm pretty sure that's how it happened.
Somebody was probably Kelso, right?
I think it was Denny, yeah.
Because you get appointed, don't you?
You don't really apply in the same way.
Okay.
Yeah.
I do remember Denny either calling me or we were just talking, and he did ask me who I thought should follow him. Uh-huh. So your name did come up, so.
Okay.
I don't think I was the guy that nominated you, but I certainly endorsed going in that direction. Okay. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think he actually might have called me when he had decided too.
Okay.
So I had veto power.
Okay. Yeah, you should. and I think it probably was pretty clear that, I mean, it was pretty clear that Linda wasn't really interested in that type of thing. It would have taken, I mean, in fact, she didn't stay that long.
No,
after
she
that,
wasn't
right?
around so, much longer.
Yeah, yeah. And then. Bob would have been a potential, but he was focused on the research stuff.
He was in his right position.
Yeah. And
Elizabeth Andrews, became director eventually.
So she
was another candidate, but probably not enough experience at that
point. Right, at that point, she hadn't been working that long.
And you were willing to move from Dillingham to Juneau? Because at that point, the job was in Juneau, right?
Yeah.
You had to be here.
Yeah. It wasn't much remote. Well, it was remote work, but it was not the same kind of remote work.
Right.
So that was a big deal. But I had been down here a few times as part of the stuff, so that helped a little bit.
The initiative failure, I mean, in some ways you might think about that, but that just opened up all these other things we had to do. So,
right.
So what were the main challenges and assignments when you got down here?
the ones that stand out the most are, just personal ones of finding a place to live and figuring out how to live in Juneau. But then it was kind of parallel in some ways to moving to Dillingham, which was figuring out how this department works and what the job really is. And, that kind of felt like it absorbed a lot of time and attention and of course that was all in transition too, because it was a new, it was a new administration and new
Sheffield, right?
And new
commissioner.
New commissioner, and let's see. Collinsworth.
It was Collinsworth, yeah. Right, who had already been deputy.
Right. So he was became commissioner, and then Denny, and then as deputy. So I think for the most part, I mean, I pictured mostly positive because of that, but you're right, it did start creating a whole bunch of different kinds of work, and for me it created a whole bunch of different kinds of work too. So I told Jim this story that I really, for a little while after you guys raised, were asking these questions, wanted to talk about this, I started thinking to myself, what did I do? What did I do as director? But I did find some notebooks.
Right.
And I found some notebooks that, list. They're not very good notes, and they're very sketchy notes. But just the one day with, four major issues of, now Chena Caribou, talk to Elizabeth Andrews about this, talk to somebody in Southeast about something, and went to some staff, some director level staff meeting. So that gave me a little more sense of, seemed like there was always something. It was always full of things. But it really kind of, for me at least, it kind of all is kind of a blur. I mean, a lot of ways, it just, I don't remember a lot of the details and specific issues. Like I could not tell you when some of those those critical issues, like whether it's Tionic or Elgin at Caribou, but it felt like my job, what I took as my job to be was, again, I think as a translator, I mean, I wanted to make sure that the people who were out there, who knew, who were on the ground, had support they needed and could do their jobs, and that job was still, a critical one of being able to describe and explain subsistence and how it worked in people's lives, and then how to connect that to the management system, what the relationship would be to the management system, and most of that was really how to keep management system out of people's lives. It was how to not change. I mean, that was the whole point of the subsistence law, was to protect and maintain these opportunities, which was an ongoing struggle, because the other interpretation was, let's use the subsistence law to control people's lives, yeah. control people. Yeah. So, yeah. so, you know, so that was just kind of like an ongoing, you know, within the department, within, you know, with other entities, and then trying to support the policy, the upper level policy makers, whether it was at the department level or legislature or whatever, give them good information. And again, a lot of that was not me. It was trying to make sure that the people that actually mm-hmm. could do that, mm-hmm. you know, were in the room or could, you know, provide information. So, yeah, so Bob's role as research director just became, you know, more and more significant because had to have somebody that helped provide support to the mm-hmm. regional staff and the people doing the work of the division, and then the whole area of communications was always under developed, but we recognized the need for it, and eventually managed to get Mag Dance and other people involved in some of that, which I think was another really good piece of what we did. And try to communicate about the value of subsistence. So we'd kind of try to do that whenever you got the opportunity to talk to people. But probably the biggest shock probably really was just the nitty gritty of how Fish and Game worked and the budget stuff and the interdepartmental politics and maintaining and the boards, and then of course that was the other big piece of things, was sort of working to try and incorporate this stuff into the board process and not getting left out or cut out from
involvement. Was that a threat after the repeal, still being left out, ignored?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was because it was still, a lot of the same issues were still there. I mean, just because the law still had all the issues of how you implement it, and exactly what you were saying earlier, that then in a lot of ways it was really a bigger challenge than it was a more complicated challenge than just facing a repeal of the underlying law. It was actually how to make it work. So it was really the same, a lot of the same dynamic. Do you try and solve issues, you know, real issues, or do you get pulled into, you know, things where people can make political statements and divert, you know, pull away from the actual, you know, the actual implementation. One of the things I remember being really interested in was, of course, there was the increasing interest in ANILCA and how, you know, did this stuff really meet ANILCA requirements? And especially here in Southeast was the whole 810, the land use issues that were raised by ANILCA. And we started getting a lot of interest because of the Tongass management was one of them. We started to get a lot of interest from advocates and lawyers about Section 810 and whether how our information could be used to address those provisions. So that's how I got to know Tom Waldo at Earth Justice and other people who were working on those issues, and still are.
Yeah, that's right.
You better ask me the question.
Well, what about interactions with Alaska Native groups while you were director. How did that go?
Well, I think as director, to start with, really most of that kind of funneled through Denny and Norman and other people because the big political, you know, the big politics, so AFN and those issues. I think
But did you get much feedback about our program, what our staff were doing in rural communities? Feedback either positive or negative? Your cases of
that? I know that there were. I can picture ongoing. Issues. I think probably I didn't get pulled into some of that unless there was a problem. It seems like at the regional level, people were dealing mostly with regional organizations and regional level things. Although I would get pulled in occasionally, mm-hmm. if I'd make a trip someplace or, mm-hmm. do something like that. But I can think of a few. Some of them individuals and their things that happened with individual employees and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. where there were conflicts and things that popped up. But and of course the division tried to continue with its hiring of local people and Native people, so that was an issue that came up in terms of deputy directors then, so managed to try and find people from the Native community that would be able to work for the division at that level.
Yeah.
And that was kind of challenging. I guess I hired Carol.
Carol Jorgensen.
Yeah. Jorgensen. And that must have been fairly early on.
Was your deputy?
Yeah.
After Linda left. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. She had to have been hired at least by 85 because she's in the Chena Hot Springs staff meeting in 85.
So probably it was something.
And I think she was fairly new at that staff meeting.
Okay.
It was late 84.
Yeah.
And she was probably the first Alaska Native person to hold a position above an SRS-2, I think.
Probably so.
Yeah.
I assume so.
Because I don't think that it had been.
Yeah. And that was good because she had connections that I didn't have and that the others in the department and credibility with some of the Native organizations and stuff. But she had a lot to learn too in terms of fishing game management and so forth, and subsistence research too. So it was a pretty steep, fast learning curve for her.
Do you remember specific issues that you got pulled into, in terms of subsistence management conflict? Did director get pulled into those?
They certainly happened, but I really don't remember very much about them. I
don't remember what those issues were, like Nelchina, maybe?
Well, yeah. But again, a lot of that really was more in terms of supporting staff who were dealing with it at a regional level and making sure that we were at the table. I think I'm remembering that right. There would be the top level stuff where it would be sort of negotiating rules of engagement or something. But the real work happened at the regional level and with the boards and the.
Yeah, I'm trying to think because I was kind of the lead for dealing with the Nelchina caribou stuff in the early '80s. I was also kind of the lead for the Copper River issues, because what we were charged with doing in those those in the after you were director and the subsistence law survived was the C&T determinations.
Right.
We had to make these customary traditional use determinations.
Yeah.
And an early one had to do with Copper Basin and the dipnet fishery at Chitna and whether that should be a subsistence fishery or something else. And we did substantial research on that, and there was a major board meeting on that. I'm pretty sure it was after the subsistence repeal initiative happened. That was in the 83 or 84.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, Steve, I don't remember.
Yeah.
You were probably there, but I don't remember having to go to see, Steve, can you help me deal with this guy?
Or anything
like that. We were basically dealing
with it. You were on your own.
And I wouldn't say that either.
Right.
There have been times when I went to a board meeting where I really felt well, I was on my own, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't those.
Yeah.
So there's that. I think you're right about that. The other big deal that we were doing back then was the urban-rural study that Bob and Linda, Bob Wolf and Linda Alana, pretty much led.
Yeah.
And we invested a lot of time and effort on that, which really did pay off.
I saw my role, I think, really as making sure there were good people doing this work and doing the using, being able to use data. And I think that was because of Denny and the deputy commissioner's office, and it was working with division of boards and with the other divisions to make sure that, again, the people who knew what was going on were in the room when the stuff was happening, and so I don't think I didn't take a lead role in very much of that stuff. It was more facilitating, making sure that the people that were all professionals, and by that point had quite a bit of experience. We're starting to have more experience, we had done the research, had done reports, had good materials, so it was getting that.
You had the track record, sort of. What about budgetary and from the larger administration? Was there support for the subsistence division, or were you fighting tooth and nail every legislative session?
It was pretty decent support at that point. It was never enough money to do everything you should do, but that was true for everybody. So if just thinking back, it was typical bureaucratic stuff, there'd be, I'm sure I spent a lot of time with legislative staff and with the legislative audit and all the people that you deal with in the budget process and stuff. But again, nothing really leaps out to me as being, it was kind of just, had the cycle of things you had to do.
It wasn't a time period where you were on the chopping block per se.
Well, that did come later. I'm trying to remember now the sequence of that, because there were some. Late 80s, wasn't it?
When the oil prices really tanked and really bad for a while. And
yeah. And that would have been mid 80s, really. Mid late 80s. Larry would remember because it's when her condo lost all its value.
Mine did too.
Eventually
recovered it, but
So I think that I think my role again was kind of translating to make sure that work got done, you know, kept going at
the regional
level.
Do you feel like the fact that you lived and worked in rural Alaska and the research you'd done, how that influenced your time as director?
Well, I think it certainly gave me a pretty good understanding of what folks were dealing with mm-hmm. at the ground level, and I think helped. And I really feel good that I was able to, I mean, I think Bob continued to be kind of just a key figure in keeping all that going. So, you know, so I spent a lot of time with him understanding, you know, talking to Bob about what was going on with projects, and then working to make the linkages to the management stuff at that kind of that level to make sure that we had information to apply to.
So it made you, I was thinking would make you a better advocate for the division, having lived out there and done it versus somebody who just came out of Anchorage.
Yeah, I would like to think that was the case. I hope that was the case.
Was it true with generally what you're saying for the more northern region too? Because I'm really focused on the more southern region, but there had to be issues that were not erupting, bubbling up for the Yukon, the Kuskokwim. And it's hard to think back to the 80s now with everything that's happened since then.
Yeah.
What's happening now,
yeah.
Some of the issues are the same, but some really weren't around back then.
No,
we weren't particularly worried about Yukon Chinook. I don't know whether the interception fishery in Area M was a big deal in the 80s. I just don't remember. Or further north, you know, with the communities.
Well, it was there were like those. There were some issues in Nome. I mean, there was a crab issue. There were some concerns about subsistence crab take locally in the Nome area. And same thing, I guess there were some fishery things, some concerns about stocks.
Was there a tier two fishery in Nome early on?
Seems like there was something.
There was something
that went. Yeah, because that's right. Because I remember actually quite a bit of discussion with Jim and Charlie Lean, who I knew pretty well from earlier life. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of nice. Sort of had those personal contacts with managers up there. So I remember. Yeah, that was one. And of course, with the North Slope, it was the ongoing, you know, the land use issues. Really, it wasn't. Mm-hmm. It wasn't allocation stuff. Mm-hmm. It was. Concerns about the well development and pipeline and you know, backs a little bit of access stuff, those kinds of things. And and Fairbanks, kind of similar. I mean, there were these spot things, you know, there was Dot Lake, you know, it was concerns about moose harvest in some of those little communities,
and
conflict. But I don't remember even how it part of it, I think, with moose in the interior, it was that people tended to, you know, distribute themselves somewhat, so you'd be. A conflict would pop up in one area, they'd be concerned about a moose population, but then sports hunters would go something as the stocks declined, the pressure would go someplace else, you know, so you'd sort of have these little eruptions, but not things that rose to the, you know, Nelchina scale or something. And
so you were director till 91, correct?
Correct.
So you were director during the whole urban-rural conflict, Madison-McDowell decision.
Well, let's talk about Madison then, because in 85 there is the Madison decision that basically says you can't have a rural preference by regulation.
You didn't actually say that. Oh. No, that's what your timeline says.
Okay. All right, thanks.
It said the legislation that was in effect then didn't authorize identifying subsistence uses by community. It didn't have anything to do with the Constitution.
rural.
Yeah, I knew it had nothing to do with the Constitution, but I didn't realize the rural thing. But nevertheless, it led to a new law.
Chaos.
It did lead to a chaos in 85 with all those tier two hunts and all that stuff, and then a new law in 86. So you had to be in the middle of that, Steve.
Yeah. But again, a lot of it was trying to, well, of course, our information wasn't really all that helpful at that point. because it wasn't really about what really was going on with subsistence. It was what was going on with us, with these narrow, you know, with these interpretations of law. Mm-hmm. I can remember spending a lot of time talking to legislative aides and, you know, and people who, you know, who people who were looking to make a case to, you know, on the legislation. So there were, you know, so there were a lot of discussion, a lot of conversations, a lot of talking about that. But again, a lot of that funneled through Norman and Denny and
Was Denny still deputy commissioner in 86, or did he move on to D.C.? He was still there.
Yeah,
so that helped a lot.
So I would get pulled into stuff on, he'd ask me to help pull something together or pull information together.
And you probably helped review draft legislation, right?
I'm sure. But again, the real issues didn't have much to do with the reality of what goes on with people. So it was, I didn't really have a lot of, lot to say, except this is a bad deal, and this is not this is something that's going to hurt people, and it's going to hurt the system, and I would have been talking about impacts and
we could point back to 1985 because that was really disruptive. Although I was actually in Great Britain when the game board met to do all those tier two. I was not at that meeting, but I had planned for about a year to on this big trip, and then this happened, and I thought, oh no, I'm going to have to cancel. And you were kind enough to say, no, you can still go on your trip. And then, of course, I was thinking, okay, I'm really not needed, am I?
Yeah, right.
I don't need me.
Yeah,
But I recall getting a call from you and Carol just updating me on what was going on, thinking, I'm glad I'm here.
I was thinking that the division would have gotten involved in the definitions of urban rural. I mean, I know you did as the staff level, but at the director level to defend.
Two things here. In 85, when the Madison case occurred, and all of a sudden all these people were eligible for the subsistence hunts that had already been created, it fell to us to figure out how to issue these tier two permits and how to do all that. But in 86, when the law was being revised, one thing that we did do was come up with that definition of a rural area.
Right.
That was something we contributed.
But at the director level, what role you with helping with these definitions and, I don't know, advocacy or whatever to get the wording in the law?
The little bit that I remember about it, it would have been. We had the report, we had the work that had been done on rural urban, which really
that's where that came from, so
we had that, and then we had lawyers like the one over there on the couch and it would have been a group in the room trying to make sense out of that, and I was just one of a group of people, wrestling with that. Larry probably remembers a lot more than I do about specifics.
About
it, of how that worked. speaking of the 86 law, one of my memories, because I don't have a whole lot of real concrete memories, but when the new law passed, I was up in the galley in the legislature, and I was kind of behind. Oh dear, who was it? I'm blanking his name. One of the key lobbyists for the Native groups, and the guy who was head of the Northwest Arctic Borough at the time.
John Schaefer.
I was behind Schaefer and one of the key lobbyists who said to Schaefer, oh, he says, passed. He says, that screws us over, he says. The deal we had about the mine, the
Red Dog
mine, he says, that's going to really put a kibosh. And I had no idea what they were talking about, except that there was some other dealings going on between organizations about the but it captures for me sort of the complexities of how, you know, of the different factors, of the different roles that organizations were playing and all stuff.
You know, looking back at 86 and then remembering what happened in 92, I mean, it's amazing that law passed in 86.
Yeah.
And as I recall, nobody that I interacted with ever really doubted that the legislature would pass a law that got us back in compliance.
Yeah.
And but I also remember, I think you and Bob and I were talking about votes and who was going to go, and there was all this wheeling and dealing, and we pointed to one legislator, and I think somebody asked, well, you know, where is she going to land on this? And somebody said, well, her vote's been bought. If I go for this, will you do that? That's the way the politics were. But, you know, that worked in 86. Plus, I think the rural interests were stronger in the legislature in 86, because I think it was right around or slightly after that reapportionment started to happen, and the valley, you know, went totally Republican. It wasn't that before that. And the population was just shifting more and more to
places. And the scuttlebutt was that Hurley, what's her name?
Catherine
Hurley basically lost that vote cost her next election.
Who was she?
She represented the Valley. She was
the Valley. And she was a Democrat?
Yeah.
Wasn't she in the Alaska Constitutional Convention?
Because Krutula went down around that same time, I think. And he was a Democrat from the Valley, too.
He
was beaten by somebody who's now, I think, a gubernatorial candidate.
Is that right?
But with that 86 law now passed, which you said rural for subsistence preference,
it did,
right?
Say in the law, yeah.
How did that affect the division and implement you guys implementing that? Did it have any impact?
Well, yeah, because then it allowed us to kind of get back to focusing on, you know, on being able to characterize these.
In some ways, from 86 to 89 were sort of golden years, right? I've been accused of actually pointing to those years and almost using that term. But before that, it was up to us to go to be the lead staff and be in the hot seat in 86 and 87 to define these areas. So we had to come up with potential boundaries. We had to come up with a procedure for organizing data that would show where they should occur, what should be the rural areas, what should be the non-rural areas. And those, of course, were then challenged in court, and we had to deal with that. It was not an easy task. It was tough.
And again, I guess from the, as a director, I didn't know the answers to those things. I mean, it was people out in the, you know, in the regions who could speak to them and could try and characterize them. So again, it was, the job seemed like supporting, you know.
Right, they would feed you information when you needed it.
Really, they would be on the hot seat. They would be the ones in the
board meetings
and represented those because I think that the director didn't really have any particular credibility about that stuff.
So, as director, you didn't go to
board meetings? I did go to those meetings, but it would be Jim that would be on the hot seat.
I was in the hot seat very much.
So the director's not testifying, basically. You're just there to support.
They might throw a question to the director, and that's still the case. You throw a question. But you don't expect the director necessarily be the content expert. It's your regional person or your local person.
Which is kind of true. I mean, that's true throughout the department. Yeah, throughout the department.
But you still have to go to all those meetings.
Most of them. I certainly spent lots of
And the deputy director was also assigned to go to those, because I know Carol was at a number of those meetings. I don't think you were at and helped with.
So then the McDowell decision in 89, what were the implications of that? Because you were still director.
Well,
not for long.
Well, the implications were kind of the ongoing things up in the air, and I think the one good thing we had was the fact that we had based, you know, our program around real information about real people and how they harvest and use resources. So we kind of always had that to go back to, which is amazing to me that you still, that the division still has that. because there was the content, the research, the information, data going on, and then there was the legal system and how you can use that or not use that, you know, in the process. So McDowell kind of just turned all the upside down over on the policy side of it, and
As a little aside, I don't know if you remember this or not, but McDowell happened, I think, in late December of 89, and I was visiting my parents, who then were living in Pennsylvania, and I wasn't at the house, but my mother was, and Steve called me at my parents' house, and my mother answered the phone, and you asked, is Jim there? She said no, and you said to her, tell him that, quote, we lost the case. We lost the case. And so I get back, and she said, somebody named Steve called, and he said to tell you that we lost the case. And I didn't need any more information. I just wanted to fall on the floor and scream at that point, but I don't remember talking to my mom.
I don't. That's funny.
But so was the subsistence division's reports and data used in these lawsuits? That's for Larry.
But we certainly did.
I can't answer that question in great detail, but I think that in the McDowell case, some of the justices did cite some of Bob Wolf's work in a way that was probably inappropriate. And a number of years later, Kevin Saxby, who was the attorney for the game board from the Department of Law, he asked Bob to write up a technical paper sort of in his last year. I forget the number, but it basically sketched out our view of what subsistence is and how we described it, and then some of the alternative views as sort of a counter to what the Supreme Court had kind of said Bob was saying, and Saxby was trying to use that to get them to reconsider even McDowell, mm-hmm. and of course that never happened, but I think that just like Madison, in some ways, the decision turned more on legal matters than actual information that we could provide about how people actually live.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 So one thing I wanted to ask you about, Steve, going backwards, is that do you think over the course of your time as director, did the division's research priorities shift in any way, and did our methods or emphasis change, do you think?
Well, certainly increased emphasis on kind of quantitative, I mean, you know, measuring the stuff, and certainly the technologies. I remember in Dillingham going to the Comfish office and seeing my first personal computer. First, they had a crude computer that they could play a few games on, and were starting to figure out how to use for. So anyway, obviously the technologies of, you know, of all that. Oh, the other thing that I forgot to mention that kind of stuck when the division, when the section, when I first went to Dillingham, Paul Cunningham had set up this, I don't even remember this, these, some kind of a, what the heck was it? It was a, what would you call it? It was a communication device that would print out. It was like a teletype. It was like a teletype. And you could enter. Yeah, you could type. It had like a little storage.
Yeah.
And you could, so, but it was so crude and it was so hard to use, and it but it was forward looking. It was interesting that they had that. And of course, when I first came down to Juneau as director, then Judy, our secretary, was kind of a specialist in IBM Selectric, you know, some of the, as it started to shift into electronic typewriter stuff. So anyway, little sideline. So the definitely a big, you know, definitely kind of making more consistency between the between the research. So, and quantitative methods and use of the mapping, you know, the mapping technologies, and the, those were all significantly, you know, shifted over time. And then the other big one that we didn't talk about here was the oil spill. I mean, that was a big deal. It again added to Jim's Jim's workload, and and again, I kind of stayed out of it. Because again, it was something that really had to happen on the ground. I mean, so you know, so we were dealing with trying to support, you know, find the financial support.
We weren't sure what our role was going to be. I think I talked to you the next day or the next couple days, and we were kind of scratching our heads about what we would do or should do. And we weren't sure, and it was only when local people started raising the issue of contamination that Bob was the first person to really grab that and run with it, and then he handed it off to me. But we weren't sure, and that of course consumed a lot of our attention for a number of years. And quite frankly also brought funding to us. And it was a result of the oil spill that a lot of the consistency of approach and standardization of how we described things and collected things really came together. It wasn't that there wasn't there before, but
it
this,
kind of,
yeah, and it was because of the staff that we had. We had Bob Walker, then we had Charles Udemol there really working on that, and there was a lot of support from the Park Service, especially in MMS, to develop that. That's where the community profile database that became the subsistence, the community subsistence information system was born, or really jumped ahead during that. So, you know, I don't want to say that the oil spill was a good thing or anything, but it did create the need to develop these things. And it also put our I'm taking up your time here, Steve. But it also put our information on display.
Yes.
And then there was a challenge involved in that that we successfully dealt with. And you know, Bob and I think we both spent 5 days in depositions with an Exxon attorney at our throat, trying to get us to admit that our information was based upon what people wanted us to think. And not, you know, and all politically motivated, and we just kept knocking it down.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing that the oil spill did for us, and this hasn't really come up in any of our discussions, is, you know, we're very proud, I think, that our information has never been used to put anybody, to fine anybody, to put anybody in jail, to get anybody in trouble.
Yeah.
We have really protected confidentiality and anonymity of our work. And that was challenged during the oil spill. I think this might have happened slightly after you left, but Exxon wanted to basically, they wanted the raw data, they wanted the analysis, but they also wanted identities so that they could re-interview them. You know, and this was information that was collected years and years before. And we got a protective order from the judge. The judge.
Yeah.
That basically said that Exxon attorneys could not use any information they got from us to try to track down individuals in any way. But the fact of the matter was that Exxon was being challenged by the native class, in part by using our information, and they did have a right as a defendant to evaluate that. So they did get access to information with a lot of the identifiers stripped from that, and it wasn't the attorneys, it was experts that they hired to do some of the analysis.
Wow.
And it all came out clean.
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking too, with after McDowell, when it now became, you know, the federal takeover of fish and game management in Alaska, that how that might have affected the subsistence division, but the subsistence division didn't do management. Right. So it might not have affected you guys the same way as it would have affected the actual managers. I don't know. Sort of
it was a
question.
a lot of turmoil and a lot of confusion and hysteria. I mean, it's sort of, but also a lot of stuff that didn't really change that much to start with. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like it had. It took up a lot of energy at the policy level and at the, you know, and the lawyers and the other people, but it didn't really change much on the ground.
Right.
I mean, you know, and not right away. I mean, it did
create, I think, those, I think they were back to more tier two.
Yeah.
But that was a big deal. That was sort of, did that happen in 90 or 91? Because that consumed a lot of our, just like in 85, we had to, we had all these tier two hunts again. And the procedure that we used in 85, in retrospect, wasn't that great. It was too complicated. And so we had to come up with new ways to score people and get that all through the game board.
So can you explain what a tier two hunt is, what that process was?
Well, it was that you basically had to try and identify individuals who had some claim to participate in hunts where there were limited, you know, where you had to limit access or numbers of animals.
So they
had to create a system for people to, typically an application process.
And to prove they were subsistence?
Well, not necessarily prove. It was it's a scoring system. But for example, let's take Tyonic, for example. The moose around Tyonic were classified as a customary and traditional use. And then under the 86 law, we could identify which communities were associated with that use, which was Tyonek and Squintna and maybe some other place. And they got the subsistence permits, and that's a, you know, 100 people maybe. So, and then everybody else could either go to the regular season or maybe there's a drawing hunt or something. And there's all kinds of examples of that, but the identified game populations and hunts had a limited participation. Then McDowell happens, and all of a sudden every Alaskan is eligible to be considered a subsistence user, and you can't limit it to local people. So it's, then you're in tier two. You've got to figure out some way to individually classify.
Right, okay, yeah. But so the subsistence division was making these determinations, or the boards were?
The board comes up with the scoring system, but we come up with the alternatives for them to consider. They're not going to sit around and come up with questions and scoring.
Right.
So, you know, they might modify it, which they did, and they did come up with some questions eventually. But it fell to us
to come up with the criteria.
But then who reviews those applications and decides somebody qualifies or not?
Well, they score them, and there's a limited number of permits
issued.
Right,
but who's doing that work? It wasn't subsistence staff.
We did it the first year, and after that, when it looked like it was going to be permanent, which it was, wildlife granted.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. That's
they gave us money the first year. At least Stratton led that.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
For the 90. It was, I guess, 1990. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
We thought it was a temporary thing. And wildlife didn't want anything to do with it because they thought it was temporary. But
once they saw
that it was going to be, they as the managers and as the people that run the permit program were going to do it.
And it's still the case.
They're still tier two hunts. Yeah, the game board has figured out ways to eliminate a number of the tier two hunts we can do that some other time.
Yeah. Well, anyway, yeah, it's just part of Steve's role in.
Yeah, although by that point, yeah, I was kind of on my way out by that point.
Your way out was because it was a change in the governor administration. Hickel became governor.
And
the commissioner changed.
The commissioner changed, and and Ron Somerville basically was right in the middle of it all. I couldn't really see that I was going to contribute much, and I kind of had enough history with those people, and you know, I wasn't going to be effective, and so I decided to resign. That would have been early in '91, I guess. First thing.
And then, what have you gone on to do since? Have you continued involvement in subsistence?
For a few years, I did. I actually did some consulting to a couple different groups. On some issues, which I'm blanking out now. One was some coastal zone management stuff. Did some contract work, and then went off to decide I wanted to catch up on GIS, and I went off to UC Santa Barbara for 2 years in 90. When did we go there? 92, 93.
Yeah, the fall of 93.
93, went to a PhD program in geography at UC Santa Barbara, which then I decided I had enjoyed enough in the beach there, but I didn't really need a PhD. One of the things I did come out of it, I took a lot of environmental sociology and a bunch of different fun, interesting courses, and decided. But one of the things I decided I was going to come back. Wanted to come back to Juneau. Didn't need a PhD. Wanted to do get involved with an environmental organization. Came back and got a job as executive director of the Alaska Wilderness Recreation and Tourism Association, which was a kind of ecotourism promotional outfit based here but statewide, which led me right back into some of the same land use conflicts over tongass management and other things. Did that a couple of years. And did a little more, did some more consulting stuff, and then shifted over into my, about 2010 or so, kind of shifted into climate and energy stuff as a personal, not a professional thing, but kind of, so that's kind of what I've been involved in since then. Helped form a couple of, served on the Juneau Commission on Sustainability from 2011 to last year, I guess. Yeah, some ridiculous long time. Helped form two nonprofit groups, Renewable Juneau and Alaska Heat Smart, which promote renewable energy and renewable uses of renewable energy in Juneau, and most recently, which year and a half ago, helped write a grant that brought $38 million worth of heat pumps to south coastal Alaska. Mm-hmm. Spent quite a bit of time talking to people in Kodiak, mm-hmm. Prince William Sound, mm-hmm. rest of southeast. Heat pumps from Ketchikan to Kodiak is
all right.
So, but we're still trying to get the program rolled out. We've got staff hired, but now we're still wrestling with the Trump administration, with the EPA over access to the incentives that. But we're doing better than some of the programs. We're still
maybe
alive.
We should give Bill his
chance. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Bill had a question.
Can I interrupt here?
Yeah.
The end here too. I want to go back to a big balloon type question. You said something about real information about real people, and that struck me as an important part of what the legacy is of the Subsistence Division. And I wondered if you could just maybe speak to that with one or two examples.
Well, I think too many examples, I think, really to mention. I think from the one of the big issues, one of the big problems with the whole subsistence thing has been that there's a real world where people are taking action and making decisions and from Lyme Village at one extreme where, you know, where down to, you know, where they're fairly, you know, fair number of high proportion of the community are engaged in certain kind of activities, down to places where it's a lot more complicated, where people are doing a lot of different kinds of things. And the thing is that the subsistence law, at least in my interpretation, was intended to allow people a choice in, you know, in maintaining those activities and lifeways, but that's just, you know, that has just run up against the American, you know, the whole ideal of individual, you know, access and individual rights and I think that's been this tension from the very beginning, and I think Lonner just really did a good job of setting out the, you know, starting that track that it we should be looking at, you know, what people do and how they live and trying to accommodate that. And I think that's one of the real successes in the division is focusing on describing those practices and working with people to, you know, to describe them. So really, I guess just about any one of the subsistence technical papers probably, to varying degrees, obviously, but, you know, captures that they really are looking at what's happening in the, you know, in these communities and how people are living and pursuing in their lives. And I'm actually quite proud of having been part of that, and I think hopefully contributed a little bit to helping make sure that research and that social science, you know, has been applied to in these situations, despite a political system that is just antithetical to that, to those practices. So I don't think I'm getting at your specific examples there.
Is right on. I see a major conflict in the whole Constitution, which sets up this rivalry between rural and urban areas and different ways of life. I mean, the natural resource provisions are such that they don't want to look at differences. They don't want to look at the complexities of the different environment and the different populations that exist. And I think that's the environment that you and others have had to work through and work with. And I think that's what you've been able successfully to do with the record of research. But that's just my personal opinion.
Well, it's one I agree with. And I think that I'm really glad I had a chance to, Jim, to catch up with you and see how much that has, you know, I think this thing that we all created and worked on has done, you know, a hugely valuable thing, against, you know, in the face of just this headbutting with the political legal system that we've got, and so, but on the other hand, it's also, you know, a lot of those things have managed to continue, how much of a role the Subsist Division played in that is hard to say, but the fact that there are still people living and working in these places, mm-hmm. and pursuing some of these activities is, like to think at least we have had some role in that.
Well, and I was going to ask, we haven't talked about some of the big challenges that you may have faced as director or, you know, in your research. This is kind of a counter to the legacy part, and then we can wrap up probably, but any thoughts on challenges you faced?
Well, I think I sort of did address it in the sense that the structure, the board structure, the legal, the management structure for Fish and Wildlife is all oriented around an individualist, you know, an individual right to hunt and fish, which means that communal practices are not accommodated. I mean, mm-hmm. so things that, you know, the sharing, the basic structure of what makes subsistence work, and as part of part of this economy and, well, social economy, really, you know, the legal structure and the political structure just have not been able to accommodate those things. even in the best, even in those golden years, there was for different reasons. But you know, so some of it's the board structure and the way that, you know, the lack of ability for people to have real input into the, you know, into the system, into the board process, and for and the fact that the boards have always come mostly from, you know, the board members are almost always urban sports hunter, commercial fishermen who are looking out for their own interests, and that's been hard to, it has been balanced to some extent at different times by the people who get selected, but overall the structure is, you know, works against having that broader participation. And so even if you had a legal structure that if you know the actual decision making structure is difficult enough, and then on top of it the legal structure that doesn't allow flexibility to look at, you know, those community practices and uses. Mm-hmm. So
all right, great, thanks. Jim, anything else?
No,
we've completely exhausted Steve.
Yeah.
So Bill, anything else you want to add?
Nothing more.